Hello, listeners, and welcome to the latest episode of the Arkansas Shrimp Tank. I'm your host, Rich Jensen, along with my co-host, David Sims. And again, we're coming to you from the BRS Consulting Studio right here in Little Rock. It's been a great last week or so, actually last 3 or 4 weeks of the guests we've had. But we've got someone real special coming back for a new podcast on a different topic, but he just was here last week. But until we get to Jeff again, one of the things I was excited about last week when he was on was how many resources that were available to entrepreneurs.
Right.
So if you're an entrepreneur in a startup and you're listening for the first time, you need to go back to last week and listen, because the whole reason behind Arkansas Shrimp Tank podcast existence is to help entrepreneurs and business owners grow and make their company successful, or even get them off the ground from the start.
That's right. Yeah, it's good to be back. What a great holiday break. And, man, it's been a lot of fun. Been fun being away from you guys, but it's good to see you again, too.
it's always such a chore to get you back from Florida.
That's right. But yeah, we've got Jeff. Jeff, welcome back to the show, by the way.
Hi, thank you so much. Great to be
here. Thanks for being here. And I'm not going to go reintroduce you to our listeners, because last time it took about a half an hour to do your bio. But
we only got a third of the way through it.
But no, so Jeff Standridge has Innovation Partners. He's Chief Catalyst with Arkansas Conductor, co-founder of Cadron Capital. Is it Cadron or Cadron?
Cadron, C-A-D-R-O-N.
Right. Okay, good. Mm-hmm. And an adjunct instructor at the University of Central Arkansas in the finance. And there's the program. What is the program? It's
Economics, Finance, Insurance, and Risk Management.
Risk Management.
E-Firm.
E-Firm, that's right. And he teaches two classes there, one in the fall. We talked a little bit about on the last podcast. We're gonna jump into it a little bit more today, which is entrepreneurial and small business finance. And then the one you teach in the spring is on innovation leadership.
Innovation leadership, that's right.
Yeah, fantastic. So welcome back to the show. And for those who listened to the first podcast or did not listen, you can go back and check out more about Jeff there. But like I said, we're going to jump right into Cadron Partners and to
last week
small
we covered primarily
finance.
Arkansas Conductor.
Yeah, the Conductor.
Right.
Exactly.
So this week we want to focus on Cadron Capital Partners.
Yeah.
And so I guess first explain who they are for our listeners, and then how do entrepreneurs get their projects in front of the partners would be a good place to start.
So we are a venture fund here in Arkansas. We have three managing partners: myself, Jeff Amerine, who's the founding principal of Startup Junkie in Northwest Arkansas, and also was the founding partner of Tonic Fund, which had two iterations, and Jeff and Brett Amerine, also the chief operating officer of Startup Junkie. So the three of us have Cadron Capital Partners, a venture fund focused on really trying to fill the gap between startup founder money, friends, family, fools kind of rounds, the angel rounds, and that Series A, what we're calling kind of a Series A gap fund. There's a real lack of funds available in the state of Arkansas right now for companies that are trying to raise $250,000 to $1.5 million. And so what we want to do is we want to step into that gap and help close that while they're prepping for their Series A.
Gotcha. Okay. Series A is typically like a private placement.
Private placement, that's right. But the Series A is that first formal round of funding where they're really trying to move beyond. They've validated that they have traction. They've validated that they have a company. There's some calculable value there. That's a pretty hard word to say.
Yeah.
And so now they're trying to raise that first round of formal funding.
And you say Cadron Capital would be trying to maybe provide up to $1 million to $1.5 million?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's what our vision is, and I originally started Cadron Creek Capital, which was one of the precursors, and Jeff had Tonic Funds, two iterations, as I said, of that, and we were also both in several other funds. There were three iterations of Gravity Funds for Arkansas Futures on their second fund, which I know you've spoken with Jeff Stinson before, and so basically what we've worked to do is to try to take that collective experience and evolve, if you will, the availability of funding for our startup founders here in Arkansas and our investors.
So you met at Cadron Creek, had a little bit of tonic, and then created Cadron Capital Partners.
It was tonic strictly for my rheumatism. strictly for my rheumatism.
So share a bold move made by one of the entrepreneurs Cadron has invested in and how it played out.
So with Cadron Creek Capital, one of the bold moves is I'd have to look at a company called Mingguan. Mingguan is a company founded in Northwest Arkansas, renting tuxedos online to entire grooms parties. So every order was for an average of about 8 people, right?
Yeah.
And they were doing it strictly online and using an algorithm to size these folks. So as the database got larger and larger with more and more males, think about now, if you're and I'm getting ready to be father of the bride, right? Here in a couple of weeks. And generally, all the groomsmen and all the groom's party have to come in. They have to get sized for a tux.
Mm-hmm.
They have to do that separate from the actual wedding. Then
right.
they get in and then they pick up all the tuxes. Usually the father of the bride probably picks up all the tuxes, brings them to the church, and Johnny gets Billy's pants and Billy gets
right.
Tommy's shirt
right.
and everything's all jacked up.
And you got to have some seamstresses ready to
exactly,
do any kind of
exactly.
alterations.
Exactly, exactly. And some people are just, you know, you can't even solve the problem they have with their tuxes. And so then at the end, there's this big wad of tuxes piled up over in the corner that somebody has to take back on Monday. Well, what Minguin does is they basically hit about 400, 500 bridal shows around the country a year. They collect brides' names and email addresses, and they start working them, again, use the word top of the funnel.
Mm-hmm.
And as those brides get closer and closer to their wedding dates, they will sign up with Minguin. They'll put in the names of their entire groom party with their email addresses. They'll pick out the tuxes that they want, and those folks will get an email saying, "Your bride has chosen so-and-so. Click here and fill out these 3 or 4 questions." And it's, you know, neck size, shirt size, length, sleeve size, inseam, waist, 4 or 5 measurements that they do of themselves, and it sizes them more quickly than a clothier could. And very bold in terms of taking e-commerce
yeah.
and this clothier capability. But then they deliver it directly to their door.
Wow.
Telling them to try it on 10 days before the wedding. Anything that doesn't fit, they ship it back and they send them a new one.
Man, I got to remember that.
Yeah, and then the day
I
after the wedding.
I just got to jump in. As a 6'7 male who weighs 195, I'd like to give their algorithm a spin.
Well, now, take that
exactly.
back. Take that back, right? So they're able to size it within 2 standard deviations of the mean, right?
Okay.
But if you're outside of 2 standard deviations of the mean, somebody's going to probably call you and say, "Hey, could you take 2 more measurements for
okay.
me?"
Okay. Right. So they have that process.
They do
in
have
place
that process
for
in place.
The outliers.
That's right.
Well, they probably call you and say, "Hey, you put 6'7. Did you mean 6'2?
Yeah.
yeah.
Or take somebody who's 5'4 and 370 pounds,
right?
Same
right.
problem, just the other end of the
call
of the standard deviation spectrum.
yeah. That reminds me of 2 things. One is there's a recent thing that I saw that I couldn't believe it. It was similar like this, like getting measured for your tux or whatever it is, and you put your phone hook up to something, and it takes a scan of
yeah.
you,
yeah.
and you send it in. So
yeah.
I'm just like innovating all the time, the people
That's
with
right.
ideas like that.
It's crazy.
Second was, I wish I had this in October of 1986 when I was getting married, because my mom said, "Now, David, try on your jacket. I will. I didn't. Got busy. I forgot.
I can already predict where this goes. Cause
yeah.
I know Mr. Procrastination.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I try it on like an hour before the
yeah,
wedding.
Yeah.
And, oops, it's way too big. And it was like, and my mom had to do an alteration real
right
quick.
Right there on the spot.
Oh my gosh.
You feel my pain, Jeff?
I feel you, man. I feel you. Can't do anything about it, but I feel you.
Yeah, it's. He always quotes Foghorn Leghorn. Says, "I say that boy's nutty in the fruitcake."
Yeah, I say there.
So, tell us, Cadran Partners, does it have any particular predilection or preference for the kinds of opportunities they invest in? And predilection, that was David's words.
Yeah, yeah. I've got a glossary here, so I'll look it up. Yeah, tech or tech enabled. Right,
okay.
Tech or tech-enabled companies, and virtually and growth-oriented, scalable companies. So,
okay.
you know, we're not going to invest in a local business unless that local business has specific aspirations to go national, global, or what have you.
Gotcha.
And so, virtually any business that is intending to scale today is a tech-enabled business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Great.
Gotcha.
All right. Well, we want to jump into that was just our icebreakers, believe
That's
me.
Right. Seeking wisdom, mantra. So we're going to jump into some business critical thinking. So, Jeff, for you as a co-founding Cadran partner, what are you most focused on when listening to a pitch by entrepreneurs or when examining their pitch decks?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the first things I want, and I'll just tell you, we start assessing the team from point one.
So
we start assessing the team and the leadership team that they've put together, and effectively their credibility. And I preach this to my students, which we'll probably get into in a few moments.
Mm-hmm.
Credibility is everything. And credibility goes from your first interactions with them to every piece of paper you put in front of them, which is an extension of you. And
mm-hmm.
financial projections are a big credibility builder or credibility crasher. Because if their financial projections are, like you see so often on the Shark Tank, they say there's a $35 gazillion market, and if I can just get one half of 1% of that, well, that's not the way you size a market or a market opportunity.
Right.
And so that's an immediate credibility killer. So we're constantly looking at the team, and we're looking at the credibility of that team. We're looking at the credibility of the financial projections they're putting in place, their business plan, and you know, back to something we touched on in the last segment was really looking at, are they solving a problem that enough customers will pay to actually have solved? You know, there are three aspects. Number one, and this is kind of a design thinking moment here, if you will. Are there enough people out there to buy the product, or is it a problem that enough people care about? Number two, is it technically feasible? Can you actually do it? And then number three, is there a viable business model around it? And right. Those are the three aspects. And they're all intertwined because the cost of the technical feasibility could say, yeah, you can do it, but at the price you would have to charge, there aren't enough people to make it financially viable. Right. And so looking at that triangle, if you will, is a constant thing that we do as investors in assessing opportunities.
Wow. That's helpful.
So when you're looking at the team and the credibility and solving the problem, et cetera, as far as the leadership itself, what's the number one leadership requirement you're looking for?
You know, I go back to credibility, which is an inclusive requirement, that they have surrounded themselves with good people. Now, I will tell you, I can't tell you probably the number of CEO founders who probably should have been the CTOs, the chief technology officers of their companies, or the chief product officer, because they were the product visionary, and they should have been a CEO, and they didn't find a good CEO for them. Mm-hmm. By equal accounts, I can tell you there are a number of folks who recognize their limitations in that regard, and in their pitch for funding, they said, you know what, I'm the CEO or the CTO today. But over time, or I'm going to be bringing in, or I'm the CEO/CTO today, and over time I'm going to be bringing in someone to fill one of the other shoes. Mm-hmm. But by the same account, I will tell you probably even a riskier move is to find that CEO who doesn't think he or she needs a CTO. Mm-hmm. And they try to oversee the development themselves, and they try to manage the developers, manage the technical specs. They try to use offshore outsourced contractors, and they, you know, what could have been a $100,000 minimally viable product cost them $300,000. Happens all the time.
Mm. Wow. Fascinating.
So I guess what I'm getting to is a self-awareness to understand where are their strengths, where are their weaknesses, and have they filled those weaknesses with other members of their team?
Right. That's good. So that kind of ties into my follow-up question is, how do you go about figuring out or assessing their leadership ability at that stage? Do you run them through some tests? Do you have them get a psychological profile? Do you?
No, we really just talk to them.
Just
talk to them, yeah. Right? We will likely go visit their operation. You know, we will understand. You know, you can tell a lot about an individual by looking at the success or lack thereof of their business.
Right.
By looking at the turnover of their employees. Are they losing people rapidly?
Right.
You know, what's their vision on properly compensating people, and do they have a process to evaluate people and those kinds of things?
Gotcha.
So, you know, there are some things that you can look at. It's part of the due diligence, right?
Yeah,
we want to
yeah.
look at, you know, who are all their employees and what's the pay scale from top to bottom? What are their plans for growing their company? How do they recruit? How do they retain, et cetera?
Gotcha. Mm. That's good.
Well, we probably ought to jump off of the business critical into our shrimp cocktail, which are these little nuggets of great entrepreneurial wisdom that you can share. So Gordon, our producer, has the first question on that.
Yeah, I'm going to jump in, and I think we're going to change gears into talking more about your involvement with UCA and some of the courses that you teach. So with your entrepreneur and small business finance course, it's a major requirement for those who are in entrepreneurship and a minor requirement for those who are in finance. Is that correct?
That's correct. If you major in innovation entrepreneurship, it is a requirement. If you're in finance, it's an elective.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah,
gotcha.
Yeah.
So, and we're going to throw in another one of David's words here. So
okay.
Let's see if I can pronounce it right. So describe the course for us, and what is the pedagogical outcome you hope your students will attain?
Well, I'll tell you. I
you
really
know that
listen,
word.
Listen, I'm going to up you there. I'm going to up the ante. I don't really take a pedagogical approach to my course. I take more of an andragogical approach.
Andragogical. Oh, okay. Yeah. That's good. Yeah.
I have no idea what that is.
Andragogy is a term that is really relegated to adult learning. And so I treat all my students as adults. I don't treat them like kids. I treat them like adults. And my first statement to them is that half of my job is to teach you the body of knowledge that is entrepreneurial finance. The second half is to teach you how to be a top performer in the working world, because most of them are either going to graduate at the end of that semester, which will be in December, or they're going to graduate the next spring. Or they're in an MBA program and they're going to be graduating within the next two or three semesters. And so I really try to make it a somewhat of a seamless environment that gives them a glimpse and a taste, if you will, of what the real working world is going to be in a high-performing organization.
This isn't necessarily in my questions I was going to ask, but can you share or do you know where most of your students that come out end up? Do they end up going into business for themselves? Do they end up with large companies? Do they
It's really a mix. So the Innovation Entrepreneurship Program is relatively new. And so there are folks in my classes today who have operating companies that they're trying to get off the ground, and they're operating. Some of them end up going into larger companies as, you know, financial analysts, as staff accountants, and in other roles. So it's really a mix today. My hope and dream going forward is that we can see more and more of those students coming out of that class and actually starting their own companies. In fact, one of the requirements I have is that they have to actually present an idea for a business to the class at the end of the semester.
That's excellent. Get some good ideas going.
That's right.
Which ones are worth pushing along.
It's exciting, to be kind of it's fresh. It's on the kind of on the front edge, but it's going to be neat to see what comes out.
I'm very excited
about
that.
Over the next years to come. It's really neat, really exciting.
So the course syllabus mentions that other topics covered are, quote, venture capital growth and exit strategies. So how do you teach that, and what outcomes do you see there?
Well, so we want to expose these students to what's happening in the real investment world out there, that venture funds and venture firms, the VCs, they're looking at companies in very specific ways. They're running their own valuations. They have their own models for those valuations. We will give the students some examples of how to run some valuation models. We'll have them do a case study or two. But then we also like to talk about the various exit strategies. You know, is it a wind down strategy, and where might a wind down strategy be an appropriate exit? Is it an actual sell to an existing owner, management buyout, or to a kind of a succession strategy where we're going to sell to somebody we know, either in the business or in the management of the business or what have you? Is it a, take on venture capital and exit in that capacity or continue with it? Or is it take it IPO? And so we want to expose the students to the continuum of, if you will, of all of the potential exit strategies and talk about where they might see one versus the other.
Yeah. One of the course objectives is for students to comprehend the different investment harvesting alternatives and be able to compare these choices in terms of a venture valuation. Explain what investment harvesting alternatives are for our listeners.
Yeah, similar to what we just talked about. How are they, as a small business and venture owner, how are they going to extract maximum value out of their business when they decide to exit?
You're talking about that and thinking that either the students or the people who come to you for entrepreneurial consultation, beginning with the end in mind.
So, yeah,
what's
absolutely
your exit strategy? What's your end game?
Not to deviate too much, but, there's some research out there that says that some 13 million businesses are going to change hands in the next 5 to 7 years because of the silver tsunami.
Right.
I think you've talked to Mark and Elise over the last few months, right?
Yep. In fact, I think we talked with Elise about that.
Yeah.
Well, that's Elise Stroud for our regular listeners.
Yeah, that's a big issue, right? That is a huge issue. Mm-hmm. And my experience is if you step away from the scalable ventures of the ones that have formal venture funding, just talk about the family-owned businesses.
Right.
I mean, that's huge. And many of those folks think that they're going to sell their business for $3 million, and that's going to be their retirement, and they're going to ride off into the sunset, and everyone's going to live happily ever after. What they don't understand is that when they when you extract them out of that business, it loses 90% of its value, and it's probably not worth $300,000, and that's not a sustainable retirement. And so I've begun having some conversations with, whether it's an HVAC company or a plumbing company with 12 employees or what have you, about how can you begin thinking 4 or 5 years to 10 years away from your exit. How can you begin thinking about ways to extract maximum value out of that exit? Whether it's some owner financing options, whether it's building some processes and some talent around you that make the business sustainable without you, what Gino Wickman would call your entrepreneurial operating system. And so, you know, those are some real things that I want students to understand as well. That an absentee owner, you really can't be an absentee owner, and you shouldn't aspire to be an absentee owner, but let's be frank about it. A business where the owner is less involved in the day-to-day operations, if the business is healthy, is more valuable.
Yep, that's really true.
It's interesting. We have a client he's a retired president of some of the local banks here. He's been with a few of them. And now he's consulting with folks with small businesses. And he says one of the things is these people have been kind of taking a lot of money out of the business and not showing it on their tax returns. Some legitimately, some kind of not so legitimately. And he says, if you want to sell this thing, you've got to be able to show financials that support what you're claiming. And that's a mistake that people can make that they shouldn't make. But boy, if they do, it's huge.
It's a huge mistake. And it's the immediate gratification mentality that we have in society today. Mm-hmm. It's the monthly payment mentality. Mm-hmm. How much is it going to cost me per month? Not what's the real value of it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's about, you know, if I think about, can I afford this car payment today? Yeah, I can. But this car payment today is going to actually force me to pay 3 times the value of the car over the life of the loan.
Right.
You know, if you equate the inverse of that to your business, can I not take as much money out of my business today and reinvest and grow my business to something that's going to be much more valuable in the future?
Yeah.
So it's the same concept. It's just an inverse.
You're helping them think of it from multifaceted.
That's right.
Turn it upside down. Look at it, you know, inside out.
Well, it's to ask the question, what is your exit strategy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And most entrepreneurs, even scalable ventures, you ask them their exit strategy and they go, well,
I hadn't thought about that.
I just want to build a great company. Well, you know, for most venture, and that's great. You know, we want people to build great companies.
Right.
But for a venture investor in a scalable venture, they make their money on the exit.
Right.
So they're going to want to know what the exit is.
What's the end game?
And if you start even with a non-scalable or more lifestyle business or a family-owned business, to know what your exit strategy is, to begin with that end in mind, as you said, and as Stephen Covey has said, then that allows you to build back from that so that you can arrive there more safely. And again, the theme being to how to de-risk your business.
Yeah. Now, Rich, that your next question is, I already stole your thunder on that from the previous podcast, man, on that course objective. So you can jump down to that to take mine.
All right. Okay, so what's a great student success story or a particularly rewarding high point for you as a teacher when you student kind of get what you're teaching?
You know, to see their faces the first day of class. Well, I'll give you an example. I had a guy, first day of class, he said, now, one thing that I don't allow even one occurrence of in any of my contracts, it's a non-negotiable item, is I don't allow, for an A or a B, depending on the other requirements, I might allow one for a C if the other requirements are high enough, but I don't allow what I call an unnotified absence, just not showing up for work or for class. And I had, at first day of class, I had this one guy, he said, you mean to tell me if I contract for a B and I have just one instance of an unnotified absence that I'm gonna get an F? And I said, let me ask you this question. Do you have a job? And he said, yes, sir. And this is in front of 42 students, right? I said, do you have a job? And he said, yes, sir. And I said, would you ever just not show up for work? He said, no, sir. And I said, why not? And he said, because my boss would fire me. And I said, an F equals fired.
Good.
And
like it.
Could you see the light bulb above?
Yeah, I did.
You got the point. Yeah,
and you know, and that guy did great. He did great throughout the semester. I think he might have had perfect attendance throughout the entire. You know, even if you know you're not going to, if you're not going to be there, you know, prior to 60 seconds before the class starts that you're not going to be there.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah. You know, and it just shows the power of expectations.
Yeah.
And, you know, we talked about it, and that thing is you emphasize excellence. And that's one of the things, Jeff, from reading your bio and all the things you've done and all the success you've had is, and it shines through even on the Top Performers Field Guide and the Innovators Field Guide, your books that we have here. It just shines through. I mean, it's excellence is at the core. It's a core value in terms of how you approach life, how you approach work, how you approach teaching. And so you expect it from...
I do.
Yeah, your students.
I have been accused of expecting more out of myself than people around me are comfortable expecting out of themselves.
Hmm. Yeah.
And that's probably true. I think if you were to talk to my daughters, they would tell you that that's absolutely true. And I know my wife would. And let's be clear, right? I fail miserably at excellence sometimes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, none of those are perfect.
No, absolutely not. And I fail miserably at excellence, but that doesn't mean that it ceases to be an aspiration.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was having this conversation with my son, my 13-year-old son, yesterday about the reason why I loved math. And we were talking about it when we were leaving from here. To go coach a game where we got thumped yesterday, unfortunately. But I said, you know, I asked him about how his school went and everything else. And I said, you know, that's why at least I love math. He told me about a perfect score he got on a test. I said, doesn't that feel great?
Yeah.
Perfection, you know, because you don't always get perfection. Yes, that's why I love math, you know. You can always nail it. If you got 100%, man, you nailed it.
It's not subjective.
Yeah, it's not subjective.
Well,
there's something about that.
Talk about sports and teams. You know, it kind of goes to, you know, those early non-competitive years when they're in second, third, and fourth grades where they don't keep score.
Right.
I promise you, parents are keeping score.
Yeah. Yeah,
and the kids are keeping score, right?
Exactly.
And so, so we do. We keep score in the world, and you know, I want to teach these students how to keep score against their own capabilities.
Well, in the reality, you worked for Axiom.
Yeah,
they kept score every nanosecond of your employment there, didn't they?
Well, it's like I tell people all the time. You know, I had a $70 million, $75 million business unit, and you know, if I achieved 99%, that means that I was 1% a failure, which people say, yeah, but what's the big deal there? Well, it's about seven jobs.
Right.
That's
right.
About seven people's
1%
jobs.
1% of 70 million is a lot.
It's about seven people's jobs.
Yeah.
You know,
wow.
to be honest.
I've got one more question, then we're going to wrap up. But Lean Canvas, I'm looking at your syllabus here, and it talks about September 6th, you actually talked about developing a business idea, Lean Canvas intro. What's the Lean Canvas?
So the Lean Canvas is a tool that we as entrepreneurial support organizations and most of the organizations around the state and around the country that do entrepreneurial support like we do, they use the Lean Canvas. And it was originated by a guy named Alexander Osterwalder and then perfected by a guy named Steve Blank and then finally kind of improved by a guy called named Ash Marya. Ash Marya wrote a book called Running Lean. And in that, he took the business model canvas that Steve Blank had kind of perfected, and he created what he calls the Lean Canvas, business model canvas. And it really is a one-page business plan. It has 9 boxes, and it really guides entrepreneurs through getting to the essence of that which is their business in order to help them de-risk that business. What are the 2 or 3 problems you're trying to solve? Kind of question number 1. Who are the target customers that experience that problem to the greatest degree? Question number 2. And before you do anything else with your Lean Canvas, actually going out and validating that those people would agree with you that that is a big problem. And it's not just a nuisance, as we mentioned earlier. It's a problem that they're willing to solve. And then there are other, you know, boxes to fill out. There's, okay, what's your unique value proposition? What's your unique competitive advantage? What is your actual solution? What are the revenue streams? What are the cost structures? What are the key performance indicators or the key metrics you're going to measure? And so about 9 items there. And, wow. And Ash Marya, actually, if you go to arconductor.org and you click on Get Involved and Resources, we actually have a copy of that Lean Canvas there, as well as some instructional materials there, and a link to a YouTube video of the author of Running Lean, Ash Marya, actually completing a Lean Canvas in about 20 minutes. And
wow.
So,
interesting. You gotta watch that. Yeah.
His subtitle of his book, Running Lean, is iterating. I think it's called Iterating from Plan A to a Plan That Works.
Wow.
And so it's rapid iteration. If you take the lean startup movement, which was perfected by Eric Ries, and you take what's called agile software development, which is about repeat iterations, and you take design thinking and you wrap it all around that. That's kind of what we try to drive our entrepreneurs. It's a process for entrepreneurs.
You just gave us about four concepts and phrases out there that's probably going to last another year of shows here. So
well, you know,
I'm really glad you committed to come back.
Hey, happy to do it. Happy to do it.
Hey, Jeff, we want to thank you so much for coming on the program today. For folks that want to get in touch with you and didn't listen to the first podcast, what's the best way for them to do so?
www.arconductor.org. ARConductor or jeffs@arconductor.org. That's my direct email address.
Well, again, thanks for being on the show, and we're looking forward to having you back many, many times. For our listeners, make sure to catch the post-show video wrap-up on our YouTube channel. And if you want to hear past guests and even Jeff's previous podcast, if you missed it, go to our website at arkansas.shrimptankpodcast.com. And so you don't miss a single episode, go ahead and subscribe through iTunes. Until then, remember, to become a shark in the business world, we all start out as shrimp.